to speak. It's great to be with you. I'm just going to share my screen with you. I've got a few things to share by PowerPoint. I hope that's going to be helpful. There will be time for questions at the end, and probably the best way to ask questions is to use the chat feature. I'll try and take live questions as well, but it's probably easiest given that there are so many of you, if you write a question using the chat feature, and hopefully I'll have a go answering it towards the end. I'm just to clarify, I'm not going to teach the Bible to you this morning for reasons that will be obvious, I think, but I am going to mention some of the Bible passages that are pertinent to this issue, and we'll assume that you've done some of the work on them already. I think there are three biblical foundations that we need to keep in mind when thinking about women's ministry. First of all, that men and women are equal in value, both in creation and also in redemption. I think it's 1 Peter tells us that we are co-heirs together of the gracious gift of life. So that's non-negotiable. Men and women are equal. And sometimes we need to think through, how do we demonstrate that? How do we show that we value men and women equally? Secondly, men and women are different in ways that point to the gospel. So not only within marriage, but I take it within church life, the fact that men and women have different roles is in some way to point to the great relationship that Christ has with his church. And we have an opportunity to model the gospel in the way that we relate together, not just in marriage, but in church life. So 1 Corinthians 11, Ephesians 5, 1 Timothy 2, Titus 2, all tell us that men and women have different roles in the family and the church, which of course is the household of God. So that's the second thing to bear in mind. And I take it that that means that if male leadership in the family and the church is exercised in a Christ-like way, then women will flourish, because it is for their good that men lead well, but to do it in a way that models Christ. So those are the three important foundations, I think, that it's helpful to bear in mind as we think about this issue. But what does it look like specifically in local church ministry? Well, there is a spectrum of views on what word ministry women can be involved in, and that's determined to some extent by the emphasis people place on one New Testament passage over and above all the others. Now, I've tried to show this in the table. I don't know if you can see that. It looks a bit small on my screen, but anyway. So broadly speaking, most conservative evangelicals would position themselves somewhere between the egalitarian view on the left of this spectrum and the more hierarchical view on the right. But even amongst complementarians, you'll be aware that there's still a range of views on what word ministry women can be involved in. So some would use 1 Corinthians 11 as the top trump, if you like, and would view other New Testament passages through the lens of that passage. They argue that since Paul allows wives to pray and prophesy in the mixed gathering, providing they were doing so under the authority of their husbands, then it's okay for women to preach to mixed congregations, providing they are under the authority of a male teaching elder. Now, I don't hold that view, but I do know that some complementarians do. And I think Tim and Kathy Keller would model that in their teaching ministry together. You may be aware that Kathy does teach to mixed groups, but only under Tim's authority. So he's always present when she does that. Other complementarians would stress 1 Timothy 2 and view the other New Testament passages through the lens of that passage, particularly verse 12, arguing that since Paul prohibits women from exercising teaching authority over men, then it's not appropriate for them to preach in mixed gatherings. Whether or not this prohibits women from leading mixed Bible study groups is something that I think different churches would have different policies on. I think a lot depends on whether you think the teaching in a Bible study group carries the same authority as a sermon. We could probably debate that one if you wanted to. But where I think there is total agreement amongst complementarians is in their understanding of Titus 2, where Paul urges godly older women to be involved in the teaching, training, and discipling of younger women. Now, it's not that Paul and the other teaching elders can't teach women in their congregations. Clearly they can and they should. nor does it mean that husbands don't have a teaching role within the family. Clearly they do and should exercise that. But men cannot adequately disciple women because they cannot model what it means to be a godly woman to them, nor should they try. So godly older women are needed in the teaching, training and discipling of younger women. Now, I'm guessing that that's not news to any of you. So let's have a think particularly about how can we promote an effective women's ministry within the local church. I think I've got 7 points here altogether, some are longer than others. So I think firstly, and this is probably obvious, but I think it does need to be said, we should value women and their role in the, because as a constituency, we have a high view of preaching and it's right that we should. I think sometimes that is really considered the only valuable word ministry. And of course, it's not the only one. You do need preaching in order for a church to exist, but it's not the only important word ministry. And so the senior pastor or the vicar is absolutely key in this. If he commends women's ministry in a positive way, then I think the whole church will value the ministry of women and will understand the unique contribution that they make to the life of the local church. Actually, of course, the same is true if the senior pastor commends children's ministry or youth ministry. If they are heard to be commending it, then the church family will value it. And of course, the opposite is true. If they never talk about it at all, then the church family will think it's not very valuable. So it's important to affirm women's ministry positively. I think we mustn't just define it in terms of what women cannot do. I think that's a mistake we've made as a constituency over the last 30 years or so. We need to be positive about what they are needed to do. And therefore we need to value the unique role that women have in discipling other women. And I think the senior minister, the senior pastor needs to be heard to commend that. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you will need to decide what word ministry you want women to be involved in. The Bible must drive the ministry as it does in all other word ministries in the church. So women's ministry is not about being a woman, a wife or a mother. I think a lot of people make that mistake. In the same way that children's ministry is not about being a child or youth ministry is not about being a teenager. Women's ministry is not about being a woman per se, nor is it, does it involve running a series of topical talks or identity or childlessness or contentment or parenting. That's not women's ministry, as I understand the New Testament. Women's ministry is about teaching the Bible to women, and that's completely different, where there is serious engagement with the text, so that women grow in their understanding of who the Lord Jesus is and what he's done for them, leading to greater maturity and greater Christ-likeness. But it's not just that. I think it also means equipping women for the task of evangelism, so that women can confidently speak of the Lord Jesus within their particular networks. And let's face it, women have very unique networks that other men don't have, whether it's within the family or at the school gate, with the school community, other social networks. But it's not just that either. I think women's ministry also means training women to teach the Bible to other women, to do that effectively, which then secures and multiplies the effectiveness of women's ministry in the future. So we're not just talking about events here, we're talking about equipping people for evangelism, we're talking about training people to be good Bible teachers. Not everyone's going to be a formal Bible teacher, but all of us should be able to share Christ with our family, with our friends, and I think to open up the Bible one-to-one with someone and to know how to unearth the treasure that is within those Bible passages. So if you're a senior pastor or a vicar, you will need to decide in what context you're happy for women to teach, whether through one-to-one Bible study or in small group Bible studies. I used to be on the staff at St. John's Tunbridge Wells, and I'm still a member of the church family there, although not on the staff anymore. And I'm still involved in leading a daytime women's Bible study group for women who are not working full time. Some of them are working part time, but it is more conducive for them to meet to study the Bible during the day rather than an evening when they would rather be at home with family. So would you encourage women in your church to lead daytime groups just for women? And I'm not just talking about mums. I think it's a mistake just to have mums Bible studies. I think you really want a cross-section of ages and stages of life. So when I first joined the staff at St. John's, there were mums Bible studies and they were called that. And I immediately changed the name to women's Bible studies and invited other active retired women who maybe children were grown up, or those who were single, who never married, didn't have children. You need a cross-section of ages and stages in those groups. Otherwise, the Titus II principle just doesn't really work. So we've also set up some evening groups just for women. So these are for women who are working full-time, who can't get to any of the daytime groups. And some would argue, well, surely can't they just join the home groups, which is for men and women? Well, yes, they can do that. But sometimes women prefer to study the Bible with other women. You can actually apply the passages and talk about the issues they're particularly pertinent to them. I think over the years I've been involved in leading mixed Bible study groups, but it's the women's Bible study groups where I think we really do talk about the issues that matter and apply in a deeper way. So at St. John's we do have a few evening Bible study groups for women. And I think for women who have been converted since they've got married and whose husbands are not yet Christians, it's actually helpful that they are in those groups rather than going out in an evening and socializing, as their husbands might see it, with other men. So I think having the option of women's evening groups is helpful. What do they study? Well, I don't think it matters what book of the Bible they study. Some would follow the sermon series. Some small groups would do that. But I do think they should do whole books and should be encouraged to study them within the context. So a series on parables, for example, well, there's probably some value in studying parables, but I think you need to see those parables within the context of the whole gospel. I've often produced notes for the leaders of our women's Bible study groups with suggested questions that they might use, but also encourage the leaders to write their own studies. Now, not everybody is comfortable doing that, but you can train them to do that. And I think that does mean that the text is handled well. I increasingly find that off-the-shelf Bible studies that you can buy from the Good Book Company or 10 of those are just not that good. They're either too ambitious in what can be covered in an hour's study, or they use the Bible passage as a jumping off point to other passages in the Bible, and it just gets too overwhelming. Very few, I find these days, now there are some exceptions to this, but very few encourage people to look at the text and see what it says. So I would always encourage people to write their own studies and hopefully give them a bit of a steer on how to do that. I think there is a place for occasional events where women teach the Bible to other women, events that build them up and train them in some way, evangelism training, learning gospel outline, doing a Bible overview, Saturday workshops, encouraging them to develop good Bible handling tools. These are all things that can be done with men, and sometimes men and women together. But as I said earlier, sometimes women are reluctant to come to those kind of training events if they know men are going to be present, and would much prefer to do it in an all-female environment. I think evangelistic events for women are a good thing to do. So at St. John's, we run various events for women over the year. We run events for men as well, and events for men and women together. So there's the full range of different evangelistic events. Some of those would have more gospel input. What do I mean by that? Well, we sometimes run what I call a level zero event, where It's essentially a social event with a testimony. So you might have a toddler group picnic in the summer, or maybe a curry evening in the winter, and somebody would give their testimony. And it's a pretty low key event, but it might be the first thing that you invite friends to. A level one event where people come because of something else that's on offer, a quiz night maybe, or a Christmas craft fair. But at the same time, know that there's going to be a gospel talk on some aspect of the Christian faith, with perhaps an encouragement at the end to join a Christianity Explored or equivalent kind of group. And then what we call the level two events, where people just come to hear the talk, and they would be invited to make a commitment to Christ at the end. A range of different events. By running a range of different events like that, we're encouraging the women to work out at what stage their non-Christian friends are at and what event would be most suitable for them. That doesn't mean they're always going to come, but it just gives them a range of options as to what they might invite them to. I know that some women in ministry have set up women's book groups to encourage women to think Christianly about the books they're reading. They can be for Christians as well as Christians and non-Christians. I have to say, I think they're somewhat limited in their scope. And often can degenerate into a situation where women say pretty much anything and nobody really challenges any wrong thinking. So I'm not sure they're that effective, but maybe they develop relationships, I don't know. I think there is a place for women going away for a weekend together, studying a book or section of a book together. Some churches I know would do this every year and get 30 or 40 women to go away. I think it's a great opportunity to affirm women with Bible teaching gifts, to use them in an appropriate teaching context. And you can run training seminars and other events over the weekend. Women love going away and having somebody else do the cooking for a change. So it's all part of the kind of women's ministry program. It can be a challenge for the men who are left at home. But Giles Walter, who was my former boss at St. John's, always encourage the men every year to free up their wives so that they could go on the women's weekend away. He would then interview some of the women who'd been away together afterwards in the Sunday services to find out what they'd been learning. And I realized over the years that these things might seem quite trivial, but actually they go a long way to promoting women's ministry. It showed that Giles valued the fact that the women were going away and being taught the Bible by a woman. And would actually find out what they've been learning afterwards. I think it was David Jackman, a former director of the Cornhill training course, who said there was a light bulb moment for him when he realised that his wife Heather actually benefited from being taught the Bible by a woman every now and again. So apparently Heather had come back from a meeting that they'd had together at St. Helens, where a woman had been teaching about the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, a women's event, and they'd been chatting together and praying through it afterwards. And Heather came back absolutely buzzing about this. And David was quite put out because he'd actually preached on that passage a couple of months previously. And Heather hadn't been buzzing about his sermon in quite the same way. But he said he just suddenly realised that from time to time, his wife needed to be taught the Bible faithfully by a woman. And so a women's weekend away can encourage that. Okay, well, some of you are going to be thinking, well, that's all very well, but I don't have a full-time women's worker to run these things. So the next thing is work with the women you do have. You do not need to employ a woman in order to start a very effective women's ministry. Some of the most gifted co-workers I've had over the years have not been members of staff, but have been women who have been well-taught, well-trained, and have been doing it all in their spare time while they've been juggling family and secular jobs. So I just don't buy the fact that you need to employ someone to do this. I mean, if you can employ someone, then great, but most churches, I realise, particularly in these times, are going to struggle to do that. You can have a vibrant work going on amongst the women in your congregation. You just need to free them up to do it and to encourage them. I can think of several churches, both Anglican and FIEC, where the women's ministry started just with a couple of women studying the Bible together one-to-one. That's how it started. And 10, 15 years on, There's a lot more going on amongst the women. Before I joined the staff team at St John's, the women's ministry was being run by three women in the congregation, and they did a very good job. Made my job coming in to move it on to the next level very easy. So the key thing is to start with the women you've got. So look out for the women in your church who have got firm convictions about the Bible, those who demonstrate godly character and have an aptitude to teach, which means you've got to put yourself in situations, or you've got to do your research to find out who are the people who teach the Bible well, whether it's in the Sunday school or in the youth group or maybe in the home groups. And if you're not sure who they are, or you want to establish some foundations first, then why not run a Phoebe course or a Priscilla course, as opposed to a Timothy course, which I know is sometimes used for training men. Why not just get a group of women together for four Saturday mornings, spread it over a term, and call it a Phoebe course, and they will love to come to something like that. Envision them about women's ministry. Why don't you go through Titus with them and just encourage them to take on that older woman role of teaching and training and discipling other women? And if you're worried about, well, don't I need to do that for the men first? Well, okay, run one for the men first, but do run one for the women as well. And then at the end of that, why not encourage them to go through Titus, if that's what you've done with them, with a group of women, and then to multiply the vision, and then just see what happens. Encourage the ones who are particularly gifted to network with other like-minded women. So this is where I think sometimes ministers are quite slow to realize that there's a whole network of women in ministry across the UK that regularly get together in order to encourage each other in the word ministry that they're doing. So the Proclamation Trust run the Women in Ministry Conference every year, and it's not just for women who are working full-time in churches. It's open to any woman who is regularly teaching the Bible, whether they are full-time, part-time, or doing it all in their spare time. And flowing from that, there are various regional groups, often within the gospel partnerships, and they would meet two or three times a year and would go through some Bible passages together, honing Bible handling skills as they do that. And of course, and I know in the Southwest, you're running women's conferences already, and I think there have been some training events looking at Bible handling skills as well. So at the moment, all of the PT stuff is online. So we're running a series of online training events for women in the new year. We've got a morning on the Psalms in January, and then another one on teaching Revelation in March. Why not encourage some of the women in your churches to try it out? It's only two hours of their time on a Saturday morning. Hopefully it will encourage the women to work hard at the Bible text. So work with the women you've got and envision them, and then free them up to do some word ministry. Fourthly, I think it's helpful to understand the relational dynamics that are going on between men and women. Now, Wayne Grudem has studied the relational dynamics in Christian marriages and on church staff teams for many years. Again, not just amongst those who are paid, but for those who may be unpaid, working part-time or in their spare time. And he summarizes his findings in this table. Now, hopefully this is going to work. Some of you may have seen this before. The biblical ideal, that central column, is that the husband within a Christian marriage or the senior pastor within a church team demonstrates sacrificial leadership in the home or the church, and the wife or the co-worker, the team member, demonstrates voluntary submission to that leadership, understanding that good order is necessary in family and in the church family. So he's not just talking about marriages here, he's talking about teams and church life as well. Now, of course, a male curate or assistant pastor needs to respect the leadership of the vicar or senior pastor just as much as the women's worker or the female children's worker. So all of us have a responsibility to maintain good order within the household of God. And at times that can be difficult. Now, Wayne Grudem observes that people fall away from the biblical ideal in two ways, determined to some degree by their personality. So those who are more passive, the areas of passivity there to the left of the biblical ideal, will tend to abdicate their role and become either a very passive husband or pastor, someone who might be described as a bit of a wimp, or a very passive wife or passive team member who could end up being a bit of a doormat. Now he's talking about extremes, and there's obviously a spectrum here, but there are some with a particular passive personality who are more likely to fall into that kind of error. Those on the other side of the biblical ideal, what he calls the areas of aggression, will have a tendency to abuse their God-given role and become either a bit of a tyrant, if they're a husband in a leadership role or a pastor, or a usurper, seeking to undermine that leadership and not respect it. So some wives will have that tendency, as well as co-workers and team members. So there we have areas of passivity, areas of aggression. But Grudem observes another important dynamic here. The way we move away from the biblical ideal, and all of us will have a tendency to one or other, and if you're not sure what it is, just ask the people around you, because they'll know. But the way we move away from the biblical idea will have a negative impact on the people around us in provoking the diagonally opposite error. So a husband or a pastor who has a tendency to be quite aggressive towards his more passive wife or co-worker will tend to make them more and more passive, anything for an easy life. And we've probably seen that dynamic working out in marriage. But the negative impact works in the other way too. So a more passive wife or co-worker who doesn't really take their part in the partnership of the marriage or the team will often bring out the more aggressive tendencies of their husband or pastor. And it works in the other diagonal as well. So an aggressive or usurping wife or team member will make a passive husband more and more or pastor more and more passive, more and more of a wimp. And a passive husband or pastor will encourage the usurping tendencies of a more aggressive co-worker. So the way to counteract these sinful tendencies is to work towards the biblical ideal. You can't change people, but you can change yourself. So knowing what your particular error is and which side of the biblical ideal you're likely to fall, you can counteract that tendency. And we have something of that going on in staff teams all the time. And I think it's useful to be aware of that. None of these errors are honouring to the Lord Jesus, of course, who exercised his leadership role with humility and gentleness. And of course, willingly submitted his will to the Father, who is his head. So there's even ordering within the Trinity, which is important to remember as well. So this means that the Lord Jesus is ultimately a model for all of us. So he wants those in leadership to exercise it with humility and gentleness. That's the model that he's presented to them. Sacrificial leadership involves humility and gentleness, and not aggression. And he wants those who are not in leadership to submit to that leadership willingly. And I take it this means that if men with leadership positions in the family and the church are going to lead well, then those of us who are not in those positions of leadership need to step back and let them. That doesn't mean we become doormats. We still need to play our part as co-workers and partners in the team or within the marriage. But we do need to understand that at times we need to just step back and let them lead. And understanding where that might not be happening, I think, is important for team dynamics. Well, you can ask me lots of questions about that later if you want to, but I think Wayne Grudem is probably onto something there. So we need to understand the relational dynamics Next one. Another thing that can help, I think, is to understand the different management styles that people have. Now, we all have a tendency to think that people should work in the way that we do because it would be easier for us if they did. Sadly, life is not like that. I'm not going to mention any names, but I did have a former boss who said to me once, "Carrie, it would be so much easier if you were male and like me." I rather cheekily said, "Well, it might be easier for you, but it'd be terribly dull for everybody else." But I think it is helpful to understand the management style that you have and also the management style of others that you're needing to work with. People work in different ways. We know that. Vicars and senior pastors lead their teams in different ways. We know that. And actually, there is a spectrum. There's always a spectrum, isn't there, of different management styles. And all of us will be on this spectrum somewhere. But I'm going to show you a model for discerning this. And of course, everybody thinks they're bang in the middle. But on this diagram I'm going to give you, only the Lord Jesus is bang in the middle, right? So be careful of assuming you're there because you'll be usurping him. Only he demonstrates all of the positive characteristics of this diagram and none of the negative ones. Okay. So here we go. Let's see if this will work. So there are two intersecting spectrums. Some people are very task focused. Some people are very people focused. It's not that those are mutually exclusive, but all of us will be on that line somewhere. Now, some would argue that men tend to be more task focused and have leadership instincts, and women tend to be more people focused and have more nurturing instincts. I'm not sure that is always true, actually, and it can stereotype people unhelpfully. So beware of lumping people into unhelpful categories like this. The whole point of the spectrum is that all of us are a mixture of the two and will somewhere and be somewhere on that line. The other spectrum to be aware of is that some people are extroverts who I don't mean very loud, although sometimes they are, but they're energized by people. So on their day off, they need to spend time with people in order to gain strength and energy for the week ahead. So they're energized by people. Others are more introverts. They're the folk who are more energized by solitude. There's no right or wrong in that. It's just an observable difference. And these intersecting spectrums result in four different management styles. So the task-focused extrovert I call the director. The people-focused extrovert I call the persuader. The task-focused introvert I call the perfectionist. And the people-focused introvert, I call him the steady Eddie, not that he's always called Eddie, but pacifier, just although it's another P, doesn't sound quite right. But anyway, the one who's very, very steady, no highs, no lows either particularly. Now, each of these four, I'm sure there are more than four, but this is just to illustrate what I mean by different management styles. Each of them has positive attributes that they bring to the team. So the director would be very direct and decisive in the way that he leads the team. The persuader is very enthusiastic and sociable. The perfectionist is an analyzer and very conscientious in what he does. And the steady Eddie will be a good listener, very appreciative of all the contributions that the team members make. So those are the positive attributes. Now, all of us have negative attributes as well that we bring to the team. So the director may be very direct and decisive, but he can come across as brash and unkind. And very often he won't realise it, but that is often how people hear him. So it's as well to be aware of that tendency. The persuader may be enthusiastic and sociable, but can come across as relentless and utterly exhausting to work for. He's the guy who has 17 good ideas before breakfast and wants them all implemented by lunchtime. Can be great fun, but can be exhausting as well. The perfectionist may be a great analyzer and very conscientious. But he can come across as very aloof and not very interested in what other people are doing. So that's it's worth being aware of that. And then the steady AD may be a good listener and appreciative, but can come across as rather undynamic and overcautious. Somebody once said to me, Carrie, do you have high highs and low lows? And I said, no, I think I'm quite steady, really. And they said, your life must be so boring. Well, I don't think it is. But then I'm not living anyone else's life. So how are we going to summarize these management styles? The director would say, do it this way. The persuader says, let's do this together. The perfectionist really says, leave me alone. And the steady Eddie is saying, actually, how are you? Because that's more important to them. Now, problems emerge when we expect our co-workers to do ministry the same way as we do. A well-balanced team will have different styles and personalities represented so that everybody's weaknesses are covered. Somebody who has a good memory for names, dates, and other fine details, for example, the anniversary of when someone's husband died, will be a great asset to a team leader who never remembers those kind of details. You really want people, you want somebody on your team or in your church who will remember that kind of thing. Someone who is good at assessing the risk of a new project, whether financial or relational, will be good at reining in those who have all those good ideas before breakfast. God has given us different gifts and skills and wants us to work well together. So encouraging each other to use those gifts for the benefit of the whole church is an important thing. But understanding, if you're a team leader, you will have a particular management style. And it's good to understand what's positive about that, what's negative. And also if you're a team member, if you're a woman working in a largely male dominated environment, it's good to understand the different styles and where you're going to have to learn to be quite resilient if that's needed. Now, again, you can pick me up on any of those. That's illustrative, it's not exhaustive, but I hope it's helpful. A couple more, and then we'll open it up to questions. Understand different management styles, we've done that one. Sixthly, understand that people do ministry differently. There is a danger that we stereotype the differences unhelpfully. But I think it is observably true within our constituency that many of the men are more task focused and look for satisfaction from their work. So a man's priority very often is his work. I think that's true whether they're in ministry or not, which is why men find retirement so difficult when work stops. And I think within our constituency, it is true that many women are more people focused and tend to look for satisfaction from their relationships, which is why retirement doesn't pose so many threats to women because they can spend more time with the people that they enjoy relating to. Now, there are exceptions to this. I've worked with one or two very relational men over the years, but they are quite rare in our conservative evangelical constituency, and somebody probably ought to do some research on why that is the case. I've also worked with some very task-orientated women who actually find relating with others quite difficult, but they're quite rare too. I take it that your experience may be very different to mine, so I'm maybe skirting on thin ice here, but here are some things that I have observed over the years, which I think is helpful to know. Women often relate with women more quickly and at a deeper level than most men do with other men. I think that's why women's Bible study groups work so well. There's just, they establish trust much quicker. They will talk more freely with each other if there aren't men present. And they just relate quicker. Now, don't hear me say that men don't relate with men, because they do, they just do it differently. But as a result of that, because women often relate with women more quickly and at a deeper level, ministry is often more emotionally draining for women than for men. Now, again, there'll be exceptions to this, but I think it is observably true that women get more emotionally drained in ministry. I think it's also observably true that physically women are not as resilient. I mean, that's just true in terms of physical strength. They just can't move as many chairs as the guys can. But that's something to be borne in mind if you're going to be working with women. I think it's observably true that men find it easier to compartmentalize the different aspects of their life and can give their full attention to one thing and other things get ignored. Whereas women are often thinking about lots of different things all at once. So men will often compartmentalize work, family, eating, leisure and sport, whereas women find it hard to switch off from work and will be thinking about it and therefore can be quite distracted when they're at home with the family. So these differences inevitably impact the way men and women do ministry. So one-to-ones will often take longer for women than for men. You shouldn't expect the women on your staff or your ministry trainees who are women to meet up with the same number as men as the guys do. That's just not going to work. Their Bible studies will often take twice as long. It doesn't mean that they're not effective in what they're doing. I was involved in student ministry years ago, and it was actually my male colleague who helped me to see this. He said, "Carrie, stop trying to meet up with as many women as I meet up with the guys." He said, I can meet with the guys and they'll be in and out in 45 minutes. He said, "You can't do that. Therefore, you shouldn't be meeting up with as many men." It was very helpful that he pointed that out to me. So one-to-ones often take longer and are more emotionally draining. I think women are more relationally intuitive than men, and they can sense when a meeting hasn't gone very well. Now, again, there'll be exceptions to that, but I think that is often true. I think it is observably true that women need to talk in order to develop relationships, and will do a lot of thinking out loud. And that's important. A lot of women will process things as they're talking about them. And develop relationships that way. Men often talk in order to solve problems and will do most of their processing internally. So if you find that the women on your staff team need to talk, that's why they're processing things. Now, can I say this? Can I be helpful here? I hope so. Women don't need solutions. They can usually work things out for themselves. They just need to talk about it first. So I think I found over the years that when I've had meetings one-to-one with men on the staff team, they've just given me solutions to what I'm talking about. And I don't need their solutions. I just want them to listen and help me to process things. That's why I think it is good if you have got women on your staff team to encourage them to meet with an older Christian woman to pray with. And I think it's probably helpful if it's not your wife, although sometimes maybe she is the only one available. So it's helpful that women have time to process things with other women. I hope that's helpful. You may want to contradict me, but those differences, I think, are observably true within our constituency. Now, last one, and this will really only apply to those who have got women on their staff teams. I think it's helpful to implement a career development plan for them. I'll put career in inverted commas. I think it is worth thinking this through. There is not the same career path for women in ministry, but that doesn't mean that at some point they shouldn't become senior members of your staff team. Curates and assistant pastors come and go. There's a natural rhythm to that. And, you know, they will leave after 5 years or whatever it is and then become senior pastors. But women in ministry tend to stay long term in one church. So senior pastors and vicars need to think of ways of developing the role that they have and encouraging them over time to take on more and more responsibility. And I think once women have clocked up a certain amount of experience, they should be encouraged to pass that on to other women. So give them some ministry trainees to train up. Whether that means they should run their own Phoebe or Priscilla courses with women in the congregation, get involved in regional training courses, helping them out with their teaching practice classes, whatever. Many of the more senior women who come to the Prop Trust Women in Ministry Conference are now running teaching practice classes regularly at their local ministry training courses. And I'm really glad that that's happening. I think that's a good way of developing their role and acknowledging their expertise. I know of some churches who encourage senior women in the congregation, so they're not even on the staff team, but they're senior women in the congregation, to nevertheless join the staff meeting from time to time, because they have a maturity and a perspective that the rest of the team don't have, but need to learn from. So you might want to think about, you know, who are the senior women in your congregation who could actually bring a much needed maturity and perspective to your staff meetings from time to time. They probably haven't got time to do it every week, but from time to time, it might be a good thing to invite them along. And some of you may have women on your staff teams who have more experience than your curate or assistant pastor. It's a bit mad for those women to be managed by a junior member of staff when they are in effect more senior to them. So I know of a female children's worker who did Cornhill 20 years ago, but has never met one-to-one with her team leader, with the vicar. Because in his mind, the children's ministry always comes under the remit of the curate. So she has met with four or five curates who've been straight out of college over the years. And of course, she's got more experience than him. Now, you know, she needs to respect him and help him and train him up in the leadership role that he will one day have. But it is absolutely bonkers that she never meets with the vicar. And also it sends out all the wrong messages to the church family. She actually is his most experienced member of staff, but he doesn't seem to recognise that. She has so much to offer. She's very patient. If it had been me, I would have left long ago. He isn't making the best use of her, and that really saddens me. So it's not a career development in their secular world sense, but at the same time, acknowledge the fact that many women in ministry have got a lot of experience and think ways that they can use that and pass it on to the next generation. Right, I think I'm done. I don't know if we've got any questions. Let me stop sharing that, that might help. And yeah, a couple of questions here. Let's have a look. A question for Carrie. Here we go. Errors. I certainly observe the four errors, wimp, etc. Biblically, I see Adam being passive in Eden. I see Genesis 3:16, then Genesis 4, verse 7, warning of the male tyrant and female usurper errors. Where do we see female doormat error in the Bible? Well, I can think of some male examples. I think Barak probably was a bit of a wimp, wasn't he? And Deborah slightly rebuked him for not wanting to lead the Israelites into battle. Although we're told that Deborah had a judging role, she wasn't raised up as a judge, was she, like the other male judges were? So I think Barak would be an example of that. I don't think you need to find every example in scripture for the general observation to be true. I can think of present day examples where women have settled for keeping their heads down and working hard because the team leader is quite aggressive towards them. And I think that's a shame. I think bullying is a word that probably gets bandied around too much these days. But nevertheless, it is true that some people use their leadership role abusively. And whether that's within marriage and domestic abuse or staff teams, where people keep going off sick, that can be an indicator that things are not good on the staff, and probably need some attention. Yeah, I won't say any more than that. Okay. next question. How do we adequately hear and value women's voice, opinion, and wisdom, and embrace that within decision making in a church when church is led by men? Thanks, John. That's a good question. Well, I would hope that there is some way in which women can have a voice, whether you have a church council that women can be a part of, or deacons in your church. I don't know what leadership structure you would have, but whether it's the elders' wives who might be seen as representing the women more widely, it doesn't really matter how you organise it, but there needs to be some way in which women have a voice. And I think this goes back to what I was saying earlier about, as a constituency in the last 20 or 30 years, sometimes we've been so concerned to stress male leadership that we are in danger of denying the complementary role of women. And that is to move towards a more hierarchical view. The hierarchical position is not a fully fledged theological position. It's actually more observed where people claim to be complementarians, but actually don't affirm the ministry of women at all, and just stress male leadership, which I think is to not present the gospel adequately, and not to model the differences between men and women adequately. So there's a difference between leadership and representation, isn't there? So that the women need to have a voice, but at the end of the day, it is the men who make the decisions. But the men need to understand what the women are thinking and saying. And if you're not availing yourself of that, then you can't lead the church adequately unless you talk to the women about how things are coming across to them and so forth. Right, let's keep going with questions. Or maybe this is similar. How can an all-male eldership care well for women, include the senior pastoral women's voices? Thank you. Well, you've got to meet with them and talk to them. And make it known that that is going on. So sometimes, you know, senior pastors may be very clear that they need to find out from the senior women what's going on and how things are. But they just don't tell the rest of the church that they're doing that. So the women aren't aware that they are being represented, or who the women are that they might talk to if they have an observation to make. At St John's, we have a leadership day every January, one Saturday in January, set aside for that, where all the small group leaders, all the ministry leaders, all the staff, all the church council members come together. So leadership in its broadest term. And we'll have some Bible teaching from often an invited speaker in the morning. And then there'll be church business done in the afternoon. And there'll always be a Q&A session and an opportunity for women to speak about various things in that context. So that's one way in which it's very public, but actually it's going on all the time. You've got to meet with women and talk to them and find out what's going on amongst the women and how they're feeling about your leadership. They need to be encouraged to speak about that. How can elders take responsibility for teaching in their church if women are teaching women unobserved? Well, I think you've got to find ways of hearing women teach. I can think of people I've worked with in the past who have just pitched up at a women's Bible study and sat and heard me lead it. Now it's a bit off-putting for the other women, but when I try and reassure them that he's there to give me feedback, not to clock them at all. It's just really valuable for that to happen from time to time. If you've got women teaching in the Sunday school, why not, when somebody else is preaching, why not go and see them in action? That would speak volumes to the children and to the other Sunday school leaders if you pitch up just to see what's going on. So put yourself in positions where you're actually going to see the women teach. And if that really is too difficult, then ask them to record what they're doing and then listen to it and give them feedback. there are ways of ensuring that you know what the women are doing. And I think all the women I know would value feedback from you, as long as it's constructive. Right, here we go. How do we adequately hear and value women's voice? Oh, I think I've done that one. Any tips on encouraging or enabling women to speak up in mixed meetings, thinking mainly of staff business meetings, but also applies to mixed Bible study groups? This may tie to the tyrant dynamic. Yeah, it is true that women will, by and large, this again, there's a danger that this is stereotyping, but a lot of women find it hard to ask questions in a mixed environment. Partly they feel embarrassed because they know their voices won't carry if it's a large meeting. And so they would rather write their questions down on a piece of paper. And I think sometimes asking people to use a piece of paper and then just read the questions from the front is one way of ensuring that they have an opportunity to ask questions. But I think in staff meetings, just ask them directly. Just say, you know, when people have said to me, Carrie, what do you think about that? It's helpful because I've invariably got something to say, but I don't know when it's the right time to say it. So just invite them directly. And if you think they are too nervous to say something in front of the whole group, then why don't you get people to talk in twos and threes? If you've got a large staff team, talk in twos and threes and then get somebody from that group to feedback. There are ways of running your staff team where it's clear that you want everybody to contribute, but bear in mind that some women do find it very difficult. And actually, I think our constituency has often played the card that women should be silent in meetings, which I think is a wrong understanding of 1 Corinthians 14. And so you need to work hard at positively encouraging them to say something. And why not do it first? Because sometimes if the male members of the team have jumped in with all their ideas, the women will think, well, I've got nothing else to contribute. So why don't you ask them early on? They will tend to hand back, I think, and there's probably good reasons why they do that, but ask them directly. In mixed Bible study groups, again, I think direct questions. If you've got some men who are very vocal, just say, right, guys, we're going to keep quiet and let's just hear from the women. I think that's a good thing to do. It just highlights the fact that you think women have a contribution to make. Right, here we go. 1 Corinthians 11 reminds men and women that we're not to be independent of each other. We need each other. What are the signs that we've got the balance right between ministry apart and ministry together? What are the signs we've got it wrong? That's a great question, Mike. I'm sure you've got an idea on how to answer that. I think the signs that we've got it right are that women are flourishing and are happy. Somebody recently got in touch with me about applying for a job. A bloke actually was applying for an associate vicar job, I think it was. And he said to me, do you know anything about the staff team there? And I said, well, I know the women's worker has been there for 15 years and she's very happy. That speaks a lot, that people stay. So that's a sign that you're doing things well, I think. The reverse is obviously true. We do need each other. And I think to work hard at making that clear in your staff meetings. So, for example, I don't know if you ever review sermons from the Sunday that's gone, or whether actually I think many churches now are looking at the passage before it's preached. So I think that's more useful for the preacher. But inviting women to contribute to those discussions, you know, how did the sermon come across to the women, and inviting women to make that contribution. Now you want the men to speak as well, but that's a way in which men and women can help the preacher to preach more effectively to his congregation. And I think sometimes we think we're connecting with people better than we really are. and across the genders, that can be especially true. What are the signs that we've got it wrong? Well, people leave, people get sick. I think if the women are ganging up against you, that's a sign that you've got things wrong. So I was once interviewed, some of you will have heard me say this before, but I was once interviewed for a job where they hadn't had a women's worker on the staff before, and they wanted me to come and sort of establish the role and then after a few years pass it on to somebody else. And in the interview, the senior pastor said to me, "Look, Harry, I don't care what you do, just come and get the women off my back." And that comment, now it was off the cuff, but that told me everything I needed to know about what was going on in that church. He wasn't good at listening to the women, and they were trying to tell him something. I didn't go and work for him, but he has employed women since then, and I think things are better. But women will often make it known if they're not happy, and they'll either do that through their husbands and sometimes collectively. Some will be very passive about it, in which case you need to ask them. I'm not sure I've given you a very good answer there. Small point, should we challenge the male 45-minute one-to-one and learn from the female longer session? Can we truly understand and apply scripture into a person's life and our own, truly listening carefully to one another and be done and dusted in 45 minutes? More generally, this may be an example of the importance of learning from each other's ways and styles, not just accepting the way we've always done it. Yeah, no, there may be some truth in that. I don't want you to go away thinking that men should only ever do one-to-ones in 45 minutes, but it was just an example of an observable trait in the student ministry at that time. I think men do relate with men in different ways, and they probably don't do lots of chit chat and small talk, whereas the women do. So typically with the women, there would be sort of 10, 15 minutes of just catching up, you know, how's this week been? Then you do the study for perhaps half an hour, 45 minutes. Then you'd pray through the study, and then you'd share other prayer requests, and that's why it's helpful to remember the chit chat before the study starts, because you can pray about some of those things. I just don't think men do that, but maybe they do. They just do it quicker. I think it is observably true, isn't it, that women use more words. In an average day, women use more words, but they don't necessarily communicate anymore. Is that right? I think that is observably true. Men have few words, but that doesn't mean they're not valuable. I think there probably are ways in which men can learn to relate better. But I can't talk generally about that. And I don't want to make rules of people at all. Aside from preaching, do you have any view on the upfront role of women in Sunday services? Yeah, I think that's something that the church have got to decide what their policy is on. So I've worked in churches over the years who have not involved women at all in the Sunday services. And that's fine. I understand why they do that. And I've worked in churches where women have led the services from time to time and taken an active role in every part except for preaching. So I think there is a range of views on that. And I think the church needs to have a policy on that needs to be well explained. So there was one church I started working for where the women had been helping to lead the service from time to time, not all the time, but from time to time they did. But the church, the senior pastor and the elders had just taken the decision that women weren't to do that anymore. And when I asked them why, they said, well, we realized that they were doing it better than the men because they prepared better. And that wasn't a good thing to model. So we thought it'd be easier if the women stopped doing it and then just the men did it. And I thought that's not the only way to encourage men to prepare better. So I wasn't convinced that was a very good reason really, but I went along with it. It was fine. I'm not gonna fight hard about things like that. But I do think it is something that the church elders, council, whatever you have, needs to think through and have a policy on, and it needs to be communicated. But bear in mind that with the millennial generation, if a church is only ever has men at the front, then that can communicate covert misogyny. I don't think it necessarily means that the men are misogynistic, but it can communicate that in this day and age. So it is worth thinking about, what are you subliminally communicating to people, particularly guests, particularly non-Christians? If they don't see any women up there, they're going to think, does this church have funny views about women? And now that's not a reason to change your policy necessarily, but you've got to explain why you're doing what you're doing, so that the church family are able to explain it if they're questioned about it. My own view is that I think it's fine for women to be involved in leading services. I think they can introduce a prayer of confession and quote a Bible verse as they do that. I think they can lead intercessions, quoting scripture. I think that comes under the Colossians 3:16, teach and admonish one another with all wisdom, kind of teaching with a small t. It's not exercising teaching authority, but you probably have different views on that. What is the balance of women discipling women and everyone, one anothering everyone, male and female? Should it be ministry just women to women that is the mark of healthy women? No. It's in addition. So women need to be taught the Bible by men, and men and women should be doing the one anothering. But I just think women to women ministry, there is a particular focus on teaching, training and discipling women in the word, which men can't do one to one, or I would suggest that effectively in a small group. We all need to be one anothering. And the women also need to be encouraging the men to grow into the leadership role that they should have. So when I've led mixed Bible study groups and my co-leader has been male, I'm thinking, you know, in years to come, he's likely to be a husband, a father. So I want to encourage him to understand male leadership. And one way I can do that is by stepping back and enabling him to do that. And some of them have gone on to be church leaders as well. So yeah, we all have a responsibility to help one another in that regard. Now, we probably need to draw things to a close, don't we? I'm not sure I'm gonna get through all of these questions.
I think it's worth us, my feeling is it's probably worth us kind of getting through a few more questions. My sense is, because there are so many questions, that's actually what people are finding helpful, rather than necessarily us going back into those small groups immediately. If you're happy to keep working through a few more, Carrie.
Yeah, fine. If we do, I can do that. I can do that.
A couple more, that would be helpful.
Let's have a look at the questions then. How do we avoid women on the staff being crushed by pastoral burdens because women talk more openly than men? Yeah, great question. Thanks, Ed. I think it is helpful to be aware that pastorally, women can feel swamped and overwhelmed. They need to learn resilience, and they need to be robust. They need to understand that they're not fixers, that their job is to point people to the Lord Jesus, who alone fixes us. And therefore, to be encouraged to have clear boundaries. Now, I don't know how you organise your pastoral care, but what we're doing at St John's at the moment is we encourage everybody into a small group. Not everybody joins one, but the majority of the church family in a small group. And so everybody has a responsibility to care for everybody else in their group. So that's kind of the first level of pastoral care within the small groups. Now, we understand that there are times when people might need more obvious care than that. So with the elderly, for example, we have what we call a pastoral visiting team, and they might take some of the elderly on and visit them regularly. And then we sort of have the end of life, preparing for death care, and generally it's the ministry staff who would do that. there was a time at St. John's, can I say this? I think I can. There was a time at St. John's that whenever Giles Walter visited somebody, they always died within a week or two, whether or not they were expected to. So we, on the staff, we called him the Grim Reaper of St. John's for a while. So when church family used to say to me, it's such a shame that Giles hasn't been to see me recently. I'm thinking, do you really want him to come? I didn't tell him that that's what we called him. But so we try and free up the clergy as much as possible so they can give their attention to prayer and the preaching of the word. And it's the church family who do the pastoral care. But if you have people on your staff team who are responsible for coordinating that, they need to have tight boundaries. I think that means that they shouldn't give out their phone number and say to people, you can phone me anytime. They should have clear office hours. I think they need to have a team of people around them, so it's not just them doing it. When I moved to St. John's, I had some responsibility for organising the pastoral care to begin with, and there was a pastoral care team, and I changed the name straight away because I said pastoral care is the responsibility of all of us. So we don't have a pastoral care team, because if you have a pastoral care team, then someone who needs pastoral care gets delegated to that team. So they became the pastoral visitors, which was slightly different. Everyone was involved in pastoral care. So you need a team of people who can help with that. And also, when somebody might be meeting one-to-one for Bible study, I would say they should only meet for a year. I think a year is enough. Move them on to somebody else. Don't meet with the same person for year after year after year. I think that's just very unhealthy, both for them and for you, probably. Okay, what leadership training is there for men to be able to lead confidently, humbly, and sacrificially? Well, surely the example is the Lord Jesus, and we want to encourage men to be humble and gentle in the way that they lead. And that I think for those of us who are on staff teams that are dominated by men, I think we do have a role in helping them to develop those skills. Some guys have them nailed already, but I think we've got to choose our moments and find the right time. So I remember being on a staff team where one of the junior curates, not a junior curate, he was a curate, but not a senior member of staff. Whenever he preached, in his illustrations, the hero of the story was always male and the villain was always female. Now, he was completely oblivious to this, I think. But, you know, the adulterer was always the woman, whereas the faithful spouse was always the man. The one who'd I don't know, nicked stuff from work was always a woman. The one who was generous was always... I started noticing it and thought, I must be imagining it. And then I realised I wasn't. And then other women started noticing it too. He always used women negatively in his sermons. So I thought, well, I've got to tell him. And I prayed about it, prayed that there would be a right time. He never asked me for feedback, but I thought, well, I'll pray for an opportunity to give him some. And when I did finally point this out to him, he said, oh, yeah. He said, my wife's been telling me that for years. He said, I just didn't believe her. And I said, well, maybe you need to listen to your wife a little bit more. And he said, but I shouldn't listen to her because she's my wife, which then highlighted an even bigger problem. And I said, I think you can listen to your wife. I don't think she's going to lead you astray all the time, but I'm sure you can discern when it's good advice or not. So sometimes I have to say he's matured into a much more effective preacher since then. We can help to encourage the guys, but sometimes we need to pray hard and find the right time to talk to them. Linked to that, do you ever meet one-to-one with a man? How do you now navigate doing that appropriately? That's a good question. I think particularly pertinent in smaller staff teams. And I have worked in a church where it was just me and two men full time, and I did meet one-to-one with the senior pastor, from time to time, not that regularly. He always had the door open. His wife was always in the house as well. I made a point. I've always done this. I made a point of getting to know his wife more than I knew him. So she would know when my birthday was, but he didn't. I would always remember her birthday, you know, things like that. I think, you know, we just need to be careful that ministry wives, I think they feel isolated enough very often, and they just don't need me to be a further threat or cause of isolation. So I think we do need to be wise. But yes, I think it is possible to meet one-to-one with a man. I think in those meetings, I have preferred it if I've had opportunity to send in advance some of the things I want to talk about, just a quick email, so he's had some time to think about it. So it's not just his agenda, but that I can feed into those meetings too. And I've appreciated it if he's ended in prayer at the end and we've not had lots of prayer together. I think praying together one-on-one can be quite emotionally charged at times. So I've preferred it if he's just ended in prayer. We do pray together in other contexts, but one-on-one, I think it's good if he just does that. Is it ever appropriate to meet in a public place with your women's worker? Yeah, why not? You know, meet in a coffee shop. That's fine, you know. But bear in mind that just meeting two of you can be misconstrued. So I think if you have a church centre where there are other people, I think it's helpful, or meeting in his home, but his wife being present. I wouldn't have felt comfortable going into his home if his wife wasn't present in the house somewhere. She doesn't need to be in the meeting. And so I wouldn't ever have lunch with male colleagues if the wives weren't present. Will Chelsea win the league? Ah, people have spotted I'm a Chelsea fan. There we go. I hope so, but I don't think they will. How can we encourage or challenge wimp characters? I think Wayne Grudem's diagram is helpful at encouraging us to work out our own tendency and then keep working at the biblical ideal. So if you know that you have a tendency to be more aggressive than passive, then keep working at humility and gentleness. And I think that has an impact on your more passive members of staff. I think it depends how it's done. I think there must be a way of challenging them directly, but even doing that, if you have a more aggressive tendency, then that can be misheard. I think if you work hard at being gentle and humble and leading them well, then they will be encouraged to play a more active part. I think very often we want to change other people, but it's actually ourselves that we can change more. I think that's it. I think that might be it.
Great. Thank you so much, Carrie. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for spending that time to work through those questions, which I think has been extremely valuable. I'm going to do a couple of things. One is we mentioned, you mentioned the fact that the Southwest, we have women's conferences. Thought it might be helpful for Jenny Singh, who kind of is involved in that and certainly chairs the bar.